Hey, nice going. You've successfully downloaded and started to play the very latest release from peterbcollins.com. I couldn't do this without those of you who subscribe and support financially this effort. My thanks to Rex Wetzel, who just renewed for a year from Indiana. Rex had a few technical issues. I think we got him squared away. Sorry about that. Also want to thank monthly subscribers John Dickerson, Nancy Mrazek, Jason Ferguson, and Stephen King. Here comes another episode from the Boiling Frogs interview series with Sybelle Edmonds. I'm proud to co-host with her. And this conversation is in response to requests from about five or six different listeners over the last few months. They said, we want to hear from Rocky Anderson, the Justice Party candidate who ran for president last year. Here it comes.
Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor. The rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows, but do they? NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to The Boiling Frogs with Sybelle Edmonds. I'm Peter B. Collins. And today we're very pleased to have as our guest a man who ran for president in 2012 on the Justice Party ticket, the former mayor of Salt Lake City, Ross Rocky Anderson. Rocky, welcome to The Boiling Frogs.
Thank you, Peter. Great to be here with you and Sybelle.
Well, I'm delighted to talk with you, and I want to let you know that a number of my listeners have emailed over the last couple of months asking for an update on Rocky Anderson and the Justice Party, and I'm very glad to take those requests and talk with you today. And I don't ordinarily share my own voting choices with people, nor do I try to tell people how to vote. But I articulated for my listeners over the period of time before last fall's election that I could not vote for President Obama because of his incursions on our constitutional rights, and that I therefore chose to vote for you. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about the founding of the Justice Party, to what extent you did get ballot access last year, and if you could give us a quick recap of what kind of vote tallies you did get in various areas, and what kind of promise it offers you for a restoration of constitutional rule here in the good old United States.
Well, thank you, Peter. We formed the Justice Party for the same reason that you were not able to vote for either of the major party candidates this last election. I could not stand by. I really resisted from a personal standpoint, starting a new party, running for office. I had my life pretty well set. I had a nonprofit organization I'd given everything to since I'd left office as mayor of Salt Lake City.
That's the High Road Foundation, right?
The High Road for Human Rights.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt that every one of us, in whatever way we could, had an absolute obligation and a tremendous opportunity to challenge what was obviously an undermining of our country, an undermining of our constitutional republic in dramatic ways brought to us by both the Republican and Democratic parties and their people who are in Congress and who were going to be running for office. And this was such a fundamental shift in the last 10 years in this country. And it wasn't just a matter of, well, let's try to work within the Democratic Party, see what we could change. This was a party that had joined with the Republican Party in everything from stepping aside and allowing a war of aggression on Iraq, a country that posed absolutely no danger to the United States. And it was all on a pack of lies that remained unchallenged by that Democratic Party. The human rights abuses that took place within the context not only of that war, but now of this unlimited war, unlimited both in terms of the geographic scope and also the temporal scope. It's a war that could go on forever, everywhere in the world. And in the context of that war, justifying the worst kinds of abuses, not only the abuses of our own civil rights, but also human rights around the world. So we saw blatantly illegal surveillance on U.S. citizens under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, every single instance of which was a federal felony, and yet not one person yet brought to account. We know that torture took place, all of it in direct contravention, not only of our sacred treaty obligations under the Geneva Convention, the Convention Against Torture, other treaties that we helped lead other nations to sign, but also in direct contravention of our own domestic laws. The War Crimes Act of 1996 and the anti-torture statute. Again, every instance of engaging in or allowing torture was a federal felony and still no accountability. So we saw that under Bush, these kinds of things were happening. We were all outraged. We felt that the Democrats, by and large, were outraged, but with the advent of the Obama administration, it got even worse, because he said, as one person, and this is the definition of tyranny, that he would decide against whom and under what circumstances our laws would be applied. When he said that as to torturers and those who engaged in illegal surveillance on U.S. citizens, that we're just going to let it go by, that we need to look forward and not look backwards. That was such an incredibly dangerous moment for our country. For a person who apparently taught constitutional law at one of our nation's major law schools to say that the rule of law didn't really mean anything anymore in this country, that there were people, as Richard Nixon claimed after he was pushed out of office, that if the president does it, that means it's not illegal. And if those who the president authorizes to do it engages in these illegal activities, it's not really going to be illegal. They're not going to be accountable. They are above the law. It's the most dangerous thing that a constitutional republic can see happen. And then all the rest of it, the prosecution and persecution of whistleblowers, people who have tried to make the truth known to the American people and to the world. And instead of those who engage in blatant law breaking, it's those who bring us the message who have been persecuted, like Sabell was. How many people in this country know today the information that Sabell tried to make known, and as a result, she was fired by the FBI, and they've engaged in this incredible cover-up? Same thing happening with Bradley Manning. He discloses murder,
yeah,
war crimes committed. Without what Bradley Manning did, we wouldn't have the videotapes showing our agents killing in cold blood not only civilians, but then those who came along to help save those civilians. That without any question, was a war crime. None of those people held accountable, but the messenger, held in horrendous circumstances, psychologically tortured, humiliated, and now they're seeking charges against him that would mean lifetime imprisonment. So you add all these things up, and it goes certainly further than this. Mm-hmm. The violation of the War Power Clause, the destruction of our system of checks and balances with this promiscuous use of the state secrets doctrine, knocking the courts out of the equation of checks and balances and separation of powers under our Constitution. All this and more made it very clear to me that we all have to stand up as we can. And I felt that running for president would allow me the opportunity to communicate with people around the country, not only to raise awareness, which certainly is the first crucial step, but most importantly, Peter, and this goes to what you were asking about what the Justice Party is up to and what I'm up to, it really is all about building a movement without regard to one's partisan affiliations, all of us joining in and taking a stand to make certain that we return our nation to the constitutional republic that was intended by the founders and which I certainly thought would always exist. When I was growing up, that's what, to me, held the United States above these tyrannies elsewhere in the country against whom our nation always so favorably compared itself, but very sadly, very tragically, we are becoming more and more like them all the time.
Mr. Anderson, this was an absolutely great, very powerful summary of the sorry state of our nation and where we have been and the really speedy ascent towards the absolute dictatorship police state. Now, the most important thing that you just said had to do with taking a stand and challenging it. And I think this is where we have been stuck for the last few years because people differ in what is taking a stand is, you know, what is the meaning of it. For a lot of people, still, it is doing something within the system. Well, when the system itself has become rotten, how do you make these changes? How do you stand against these things within the system? Because we are looking at these federal courts that have been culprit. They have basically been the extension of the executive branch. Of course, with Congress and even with people who are not informed, if you were to look at and check out the latest survey results for the last decade, you see the confidence in Congress is less than 10%. So even those uninformed know that Congress really doesn't represent their interests. Mainstream media, again, has been the mouthpiece for the government. Yet you see a lot of activists today who are still wasting time petitioning the same Congress. And we gave up as an organization, National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, in 2008 after we tried the same thing with the Democrats. And this was after we tried it very hard with all the petition and signature collections and the rallies. So how do we stand and how do we stand united against all these things that we have been talking about, Peter and I, and what you have been doing, which I believe is the most important thing to do, and that is standing up and saying, I'm going to do something. Democrats, Republicans, we don't see any difference between the two parties. You know what? I'm going to be, even if it's going to be a lone man journey, I'm going to take this step because I believe that our nation is ready for a party outside these two main parties. But back again to this whole notion of opposing and standing against and do so unitedly when the nation is so divided. we still have this notion and the paradigm of the left and the right and, you know, the libertarians. We still have these divisive approaches. And again, many who still believe we need to go and make the changes within the system. And how is it possible to do it in a system when the system itself has been rotten?
I think there are no magic bullets necessarily, but we can take so much inspiration from our own nation's history. The movements that have really made tremendous difference in this country. You look at it, the anti-slavery movement, the women's suffrage movement, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement in the 60s and the 70s, the early environmental movement. They all started at the grassroots with people, ordinary people like you, me, Peter, everybody getting the word out. And ordinary, by the way, I'm using in a complimentary sense that you don't wait for the elected officials. You don't look to high governmental officials to carry the burden because they will not do it. Those who are putting their finger in the wind, as Jim Wallace said, and waiting to see where the political winds are blowing, as Wallace said, it's our job to change the wind. It's our job to let them know we're not going to put up with it anymore. We're not going to put up with either the inaction, as in 1994, when the Democratic administration sat on its hands and watched 800,000 people be butchered, mostly by being hacked to death with machetes in Rwanda. And our government did nothing in working with the United Nations to put an end to that. Or when we sat back and allowed our country on a pack of lies to invade and occupy Iraq, causing the deaths of over a million innocent Iraqi people, thousands of U.S. servicemen and women. The suicide rates now among our own service people is higher than it's ever been. And a lot of it, people say it's because of moral injury, moral harm is what they're calling it, because they know the kinds of things that they were called upon to do and the horrendous damage that was done to so many people's lives, and for what? So it's going to take every single one of us doing all we can. It means demonstrations, and not just once in a while. It's like, go back to the anti-Vietnam War, when people would take to the streets, when we would shut cities down. I think general strikes, striking the corporate sector where it really hurts. We know that most of the public policy disasters in this country, like the deprivation of decent health care for millions of people. And by the way, by the year 2022, there will be some 30 million people in this country under Obamacare without any basic health care. Well, there's only one reason for these public policy disasters, and that is the utter corruption in our government and our corrupt campaign finance system. So you don't have to be a Republican, Democrat, Independent, Green, Justice Party member to see that corruption undermines the public interest and turns our government into basically a whore for these corporate interests that have their way in Washington, D.C. So we all need to come together. Now, mouse click activism, you know, taking your 15 seconds, putting your name to a petition, sending it off, and then going on with the rest of your day, that's fine as far as it goes. And groups like Move to Amend, I want to see them get as many names as they can. But we have to go so much further than that. Ben Franklin told a woman who asked him as he was leaving the Constitutional Convention, she said, "So what do we have, Dr. Franklin, a monarchy or a republic?" And he turned to her and he said, "A republic, ma'am, if you can keep it." And that is the responsibility and great obligation of every single generation. And Sibel, we're failing in that today. We are losing our constitutional republic in major ways. I mean, we have a Democratic and Republican bipartisan Congress with a Democrat in the White House who all agree that the federal government should be able to go out and round up any one of us who are fingered by the president or somebody that's designated by him, disappear them, take them away as if they were in Argentina during the dirty war, and imprison them up to the rest of their lives without charges, without a trial, without legal assistance, or without the great right of filing a writ of habeas corpus to have an independent tribunal determine the legality of their incarceration. This isn't the United States of America. This is like living under the KGB. This is like living under the Argentinians during the dirty war. And it's up
Rocky,
to every one of us to make certain that that doesn't continue. And it's going to take dramatic responses. I'm sorry, Peter.
Yeah, I'm sorry, too. I interrupted you there. We're speaking in the middle of March, just a week after Senator Rand Paul, the Republican from Kentucky, conducted a 13-hour filibuster. And while I don't regard him as a perfect vehicle for the kind of expression that I have about a return of the Bill of Rights and an end to the expansion of presidential power, I do think that his filibuster had some interesting impacts. Number one, it, at least on a shame basis, showed up the Democrats who have silently yielded to their president as he has arrogated even more power than Bush did. And when Bush did it, the squeals from the Democrats could be heard all over the place. And it also has divided the Republican Party into a kind of old guard, new guard split. That may be healthy in terms of the warmongering of people like John McCain and Lindsey Graham from the Carolinas, that this could be a moment of shift. And I'd like to hear your thoughts about this, because I was surprised that the very first real debate about the use of unmanned aerial drones was driven by a Tea Party Republican.
You know, Peter, I wish I shared your optimism, but let's review this in a month and see how much impact it's had on this country. It was disclosed in the New York Times. There's a great front page piece in last Sunday's New York Times about the drone killing of a United States citizen who was placed on an assassination list by our president. Now, consider this. The first time in our nation's history when a president has said no charges, no trial, no right of habeas corpus, no rights whatsoever, let's just go kill a United States citizen. This is a constitutional law professor that apparently has no comprehension of the Due Process Clause, substantive or procedural due process, under the United States Constitution. And we killed Anwar al-Awlaki, and then 2 weeks later, they say it was a mistake, they killed his 16-year-old son, also a U.S. citizen, born in Denver, Colorado. And then it goes on to talk about the killing of two other U.S. citizens. Again, whoops, it was a mistake. They say these are both CIA and Department of Defense operations, by the way. I mean, they carry them on separately, but in Yemen, mm-hmm. they're sort of both there doing this. So when Rand Paul, a man who is a disaster when it comes to things like basic civil rights in this country, he opposes the Civil Rights Act of 1964, opposes, like his father did, government intervention with polluters in terms of protection of our environment, protection against dangerous drugs and other products. I mean, they deny government the power to do any of the good kinds of protective things government should be doing for us. So this was just part and parcel of it for Rand Paul. But you're right. Where were the Democrats? And that is why I said during this last race, President Obama, and not that I don't think my good old friend, probably ex-friend, Mitt Romney, would have been an absolute disaster, especially if he'd been the kind of person that he pretended to be during the election, or maybe he pretended to be the other kind of person when he ran for governor and earlier for Senate in Massachusetts. But I said during that race that Obama was not just the least of the two evils, but he was the more effective of the two evils. And it's playing out every single day. The fact that Democrats will line up behind him because he's on their team is so unbelievably dangerous, because now we don't have major opposition. We have one guy, and it's Rand Paul. And as I said, he's quite wacky in so many other ways and dangerous ways, but he's the only one really to stand up against drone killings. And the question was whether the administration claimed the right to engage in drone killings of U.S. citizens on U.S. territory. That's how low the bar is for opposition in Washington. And it was one person standing there to filibuster the appointment of a guy that, by the way, President Obama didn't want to appoint in the beginning, but wouldn't, because he knew that there would be opposition in this country, because this appointee favored torture during the Bush administration. Hardly any discussion of that now. You all have discussed it, and thank you very much for doing that. But we don't see it in the mainstream media during all of this conversation. We didn't see it in Congress. How many people were standing up saying there is no way this man is going to be director of the CIA? Just look at his record. Not only does he support the drone killings, which have resulted in the killings of hundreds and now by now probably thousands of innocent men, women, and children in at least four sovereign nations around the world, but he also supported blatantly illegal torture during the Bush administration. I'm talking about John Brennan, by the way.
Right. And Rocky, arguably the most aggressive Democrat has been Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon. And he comes up short repeatedly, where his argument is, show us the memos, not I don't agree with what's in those memos. And sure, you know, there are important issues that Obama, just like Bush, should not be able to keep secret. These memos from the Office of Legal Counsel that rationalize unconstitutional and illegal acts. But Senator Wyden doesn't really challenge the policy. He simply says you can't keep it secret from us, the people who are sworn into the black programs who serve on the Intelligence Committee. And so the shameful collusion of Democrats in failing to live up to their own basic oath of office, as the president has. It's not to defend the country from terrorists or from anything. The oath is to protect, preserve, and defend the Constitution. And it strikes me that nobody is honoring that oath who is in public office today.
I absolutely agree with everything you've just said, Peter. But I have to say that thank goodness there is somebody like Ron Wyden that is at least standing up for, to some extent, the separation of powers, Congress's role. Because up until now, Congress has basically abdicated its role in our system of government. The courts have abdicated their role under the state secrets doctrine, dismissing cases left and right because the executive branch tells them to do it. Isn't that amazing that we have an executive branch that blatantly violates the law, commits federal felonies, and then when somebody goes in and challenges it, including torture victims like Maher Arar or Khaled al-Masri, or lawyers and journalists and human rights workers who challenge illegal surveillance. And the courts either simply dismiss the cases out of hand, not on the merits, saying, well, the executive branch, the very perpetrator of these violations of the law, have told us that we need to dismiss them because to continue on would mean the disclosure of important state secrets, or they deny them the evidence, as in the Clapper case, and then say, well, you weren't able to prove that your conversations were subject to the illegal surveillance, so therefore you don't have standing. And the reason you weren't able to prove that your communications were subject to surveillance is because the government won't let you find out, and they're claiming that to do so would mean the disclosure of important state secrets. Well, what it would mean is the disclosure, perhaps, of embarrassing information. It would mean the disclosure of evidence of blatantly illegal conduct by our government from the highest levels. But the courts, because the government says, because the administration says so, simply dismisses the cases or deprives the parties of the evidence they need to make their cases. So when we talk about undermining our constitutional republic, it's happening before our very eyes, and those who are to represent us, those in both these other branches of government, Congress and the courts, have so abdicated their responsibility. So I say thank goodness for at least insisting on getting the memos. But man, when he gets those memos, like the white paper that was just disclosed, why are they not raising hell that the administration is claiming the authority on the basis of a high-ranking informed source in the government? That's what the white paper talks about, that a high-ranking informed source who finds that there's some risk of some danger, and it doesn't even have to be imminent, given the ordinary usage of the word imminent, that this person could cause injury to the United States, and therefore, without any evidence, without a trial, without any opportunity to be heard, to face the evidence, we're just going to have them killed? That's what it's come to, and our Congress has been so utterly irresponsible. I say, anyone who has not stood up against these abuses of power on that basis alone should never hold public office again, and I would never vote for any one of them on that basis.
Rocky, what you just outlined for us there is this incredible expansion of the claimed authority of the President of the United States. And John Yoo is best known. He's now got a tenured professorship at the School of Law at UC Berkeley across the bay from me. But when he served in the Bush administration, he's best known for the redefinition of terror to, or I'm sorry, of torture, so that the president could say he didn't torture even as we were conducting widespread torture on suspects in the so-called war on terror. But he, before he wrote those memos, he offered, and the reason he was hired into the Justice Department is that he offered the most expansive view of unchecked presidential authority. And when you couple that with the blank check that was issued by Congress, that's what I call the authorization for use of military force, passed shortly after 9/11/01. You couple the broad interpretation of presidential power with this blank check that was written so broadly that it can and has been abused, then those are, to me, the building blocks for what is becoming a serial dictatorship, where we seem to honor the election cycles and presidents don't try to extend their term beyond 8 years. But inside that framework, we have passively accepted a massive power grab by the executive. So if you would, talk a little bit about what you see as the origins of this and what we need to do to change that. Recently, in the same newspaper that the New York Times used unnamed sources and official leaks to describe the case against Anwar al-Awlaki, the editorial page called for repeal of the authorization for use of military force?
You've covered a lot there. And if I leave anything out in my response, you let me know.
All right.
First of all, I think everybody needs to be very clear that the resolution authorizing military force, which gave a blank check to the President of the United States to decide whether or not to invade and occupy Iraq, his authority was actually exercised, and I don't think most people know this, under emergency powers that have been granted to the president or claimed by the president through executive orders. So if you take all of the emergency powers provided for by statute or under executive orders, the president, with the stroke of the pen, once having declared a state of emergency, is a dictator. And Peter, did you know that we have been under a state of emergency, a declared state of emergency, since President Obama came into office? He extended that state of emergency that was declared by President Bush after 9/11, and it is in place today, even though Congress has a statutory duty to review those declarations every 6 months and has utterly failed to live up to its own legal obligations.
I am aware of that, Rocky, and also a separate emergency resolution essentially saying that we're on the same status with Iran was just renewed for another year.
Right. So the president could sign a document, take over all radio and television stations, take over all commerce, take over all means of communication and transportation. And the same president that has those powers has joined with Congress. And first of all, he asked for these powers to indefinitely detain. They weren't forced upon him by Congress. He asked for those powers as far back as 2009. And Rachel Maddow, you can find this on YouTube, has a blistering piece on this. All you have to do is put on YouTube indefinite detention Rachel Maddow, and it's an incredible piece she did on that. 2009. Now, the statute's been passed again by the Republican and Democratic political duopoly and signed into law by the president. And again, without any semblance of due process, and this has been a complete makeover of our government. So, when you talk about John Yoo and President Bush's theory of the presidency, that president is the head of the unitary executive branch, which is basically just reminiscent of what Nixon said during that David Frost interview, that, well, the president does it, that means it's not illegal because the president is unrestrained. And that was the position taken by Bush, by Cheney. Cheney took that position in his minority report in the Iran-Contra, after the Iran-Contra hearings. His minority report basically said the president should be able to do these things and not be interfered with by Congress. Amazing. I mean, his history in this regard it's almost as if he were a plant along the way with a little detour over to Halliburton so he could rake in his millions upon millions of dollars. But President Obama would say that he doesn't believe in this unitary branch theory of unrestrained powers, but he doesn't need to adopt that because he has a Congress that does whatever he says he wants in terms of dictatorial powers. And so as a result, we're assassinating U.S. citizens for the first time. We're striking other nations with unmanned drones without a declaration of war for the first time. All of this is being justified under that resolution authorizing the use of military force. Think about it. President Obama, when he first ran as sort of the anti-Iraq war candidate, although he'd never really stood up on the issue except one speech in a very liberal area of Illinois. But other than Eric Holder, there hasn't been one high-ranking person in his administration who stood up in opposition to that outrageous, illegal war of aggression. And his two secretaries of state, first Hillary Clinton and now John Kerry, both of them voted for that authorization for the use of military force. And neither one of them, Peter, bothered to go down to a secured room in the Capitol and read the national intelligence estimate, which would have disclosed to them that the intelligence community was at tremendous odds internally with the lies that were being told by the Bush administration. There were six United States senators who ever bothered to go down and read that intelligence estimate. And as Senator Bob Graham said, it's because he read that and saw that the president was lying to the country and lying to Congress that he voted against the authorization.
Well, sometimes I wonder what they teach these guys at the universities like Harvard, Obama being a constitutional attorney. And same thing with John Yoo. And every day when I look, I see that these guys are so alike. In terms of inaction, constitutionally or unconstitutionally. My question is, Mr. Anderson, what are you planning for 2016? Are you planning to run?
I have no current plans to run. I think that we have to see how things go in this country. I doubt that we're ever going to be able to restore the rule of law, restore the fundamentals of our constitutional system by getting behind the Republicans or the Democrats ever again. I think that there is no question that we all need to stand up against that political duopoly. And when I say duopoly, both of them control the entire political process. Everything from ballot access and my stories. You asked earlier, Peter, how many states' ballots did we get on?
Right.
We got on only 15 ballots. And mm-hmm. in four of those states, I was actually on the ballot as the nominee of state parties mm-hmm. in those states. Progressive Party in Oregon, the Independent Parties in Connecticut, New Mexico, and the Natural Law Party in Michigan. So, and we put a lot of work into it, but these two parties have made it virtually impossible, at least without spending millions upon millions of dollars, to get on the ballots in a lot of these states. And if you get on in Pennsylvania, the forum for the Constitutional Convention, ironically, the parties have such tremendous clout under the law there that they can get a monetary judgment against you personally if they challenge enough names on the petitions to knock you off the ballot.
Really?
They did it against Ralph Nader. They got, I believe it was a $71,000 personal judgment against Ralph Nader and Peter Kamel, and then they went over and tapped Ralph Nader's personal bank account because his bank in Washington had a branch in Pennsylvania, and poor Peter Kamel, here the man was dying of cancer, and just to get the Democratic Party out of his hair, he wrote out a personal check for $20,000 to them. That's the price of trying to breathe life into our democratic, used to be democratic, electoral system. And then, of course, the debates. They were hijacked away from the League of Women Voters by the Republican Democratic parties. And those two parties formed the Commission on Presidential Elections. By that name, it sounds like it's this high-minded, independent or quasi-governmental commission that's independently run. Absolutely not. It's run and controlled by the Republican Democratic Party, and they'll never let anybody on the stage with them that poses a threat to them. And it's unbelievably manipulated. Bill Clinton, when he was going against Dole, he was so high up in the polls, he said, okay, Dole, we'll keep Perot off, because last time it debated, he tripled his support around the country. We'll keep him off as long as you let me determine how many debates, what the format is, and when they'll be held. And Dole said, okay. And so what did Clinton's folks say? They said, we're going to limit it to two debates. They're both going to be held opposite the playoff games for the World Series, because we want to make it as much of a non-event as possible. George Stephanopoulos admitted to that when interviewed by Chris Matthews. And what a sign of the degradation of our democratic process and the abuses by these two parties. So, you know, when we talk about, yeah, do you want to run in 2016? The running isn't the important thing, except certainly to get the word out. And I did hear people every time I spoke say, I never knew that. I had no idea that was going on, because they're not seeing it in the corporate-owned media around the country. But what we have to do is change the system. And we can do that if we put enough pressure on. There were enough complaints about how perverse and manipulative the Presidential Debate Commission was, that several of the corporate sponsors bailed this last time around. And thank goodness there were the likes of Amy Goodman, Democracy Now!, Free and Equal Debate, Free and Equal Elections folks, who put on a debate in Chicago, the expanded debate that Amy Goodman did three times when Jill Stein and I, it was as if we were participating in the major debates. And then also Ralph Nader organized and moderated. Probably it's got to be the most comprehensive, substantive debate ever held in the presidential election. He did that on the weekend before the election in Washington, D.C. Now, how many people saw that? How many people finally got exposure? I don't know. But I think that all of these folks combined definitely raised the bar for participation by independent and third-party candidates. So we need to address this from every possible direction. We need to do it strategically, and we need to make it clear to those members of the Republican Democratic parties, first of all, there's a reason why millions of people have been leaving the ranks of those parties over the last 6 or 8 years. It's because they don't represent the public interest anymore, and they help sustain this perverse, corrupt system that we have that simply does the will of the corporate interests and the interests of others with concentrated wealth, and with these folks in Congress and in the White House who have taken our nation in such a dangerous direction, expanding the imperial presidency, expanding the concentrated power within the executive branch, and diminishing what the courts and Congress can or will do under what used to be a very healthy system, a democratic system of checks and balance and separation of power.
Mr. Anderson, I see that internet is becoming more and more powerful in countering all the stuff that we discussed with the campaign financing laws and all the obstacles that are basically stacked against the third-party candidates. So that's, I see, one optimistic or potentially one optimistic reason. But the other thing I was going to ask you about has to do with third party versus a coalition, a solid coalition of several independent parties outside the two-party system. What was your reaction when a few months before the elections last November, when this rumor started coming out about the possible coalition between Ron Paul and Ralph Nader, when you can have people putting, you know, some differences aside and agree upon the constitutional points, all the points that we discussed today, and some excellent grounds to agree upon on our foreign policy, and then say, well, we're willing to put other differences aside and concentrate on these areas, which is, I think, the most important area as far as I'm concerned. And so what was your reaction to that?
Well, first of all, there are a number of issues that Ron Paul and Ralph Nader and I and Jill Stein and a lot of others agreed upon, but huge, fundamental, tremendous differences on other very important issues, such as civil rights, such as environmental protections and consumer protections. So I think what we need to do is come together under the banner of those areas where we have fundamental agreement and push as in a movement. It's the movement building, not the electropolitics. And I know that in this country particularly, we're so tied to parties and the whole electoral system, but there's a lot of time between elections when we could be building mass movements and never look to the person to our left or right as we're shutting down streets, shutting down cities, engaging in general strikes, raising unmitigated hell to change the system, and never asking that person to our left or right, are you Republican, Democrat, Green, Justice Party, Libertarian? It doesn't matter as long as we're joining together in that kind of mass movement. And that's how it was during the Civil Rights Movement. And we saw such great successes. We didn't sit back and say, well, let's elect the right person, get them in office, and then wash our hands of it and go back to business as usual. Martin Luther King Jr. stopped by, saw President Johnson in the White House after the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which, again, I'll remind you, libertarians and people like Rand Paul and his father would oppose. But he said, now we need a Voting Rights Act. Lyndon Johnson said, now the country's not ready for it. Take 5, 10, no, I think he said more than that, actually, 15 or 20 years. And King said, really? He went back to Selma. They organized. They took to the streets. And, yeah, there was violence against them. And that drew so many people around the country to their cause. Then Lyndon Johnson appears before a joint session of Congress, gives one of the most inspiring speeches you'll ever hear or read in favor of the Voting Rights Act, and it passed within months. Never would have happened if people hadn't taken to the streets and come together and form that kind of movement. So I say, you know, instead of talking so much about 2016 and elections and, geez, how many ballots can we get on, we ought to be talking about how we build a mass movement where party affiliation doesn't matter. Commitment to these principles is what matters. And we as the American people still have the power to make it happen.
And Rocky, for me, one of the nonpartisan vehicles for that expression is a group called the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. And it's headed by a young man named Shahid Buttar. And I have found them to be, willing to work with all who see the threats to the Bill of Rights and want to work to restore what we had before Bush and Obama. Have you heard of that group, and do you have any contact with them?
Well, actually, I was the recipient of their Patriot Award in August of 2011. I've worked a lot with the Bill of Rights Defense Council, mm-hmm. their committee. And Shahid Buttar and I have worked a great deal together. And last weekend, the Justice Party had a national conference call, and we invited everybody to join in. Again, we stressed, we don't care if you're a member of the Justice Party, to join in this effort. And it's exactly what you're talking about, Peter. We got Shahid and George Friday, who works with them, on the line to explain what they're doing. By the way, you can go to the Justice Party website, which is justicepartyusa.org website, and there's a recording of that phone conversation and information about how everybody can join in this effort to resist the NDAA provisions for indefinite detention. And this is exactly what we're talking about in terms of finding those issues that really matter to all of us and joining together without any concern about one's party affiliation.
Mm-hmm. And in that spirit, following Rand Paul's filibuster, I reached out to Jeff Frazee, who is the leader of the Young Americans for Liberty. It's a group that is basically the surviving elements of the Ron Paul for President campaign. And just like Rand Paul, there are many issues that I don't agree with them on. But I am fully willing to work with people on the central and somewhat narrowed issues of restoring constitutional rule. And I think the only way it can have an impact and any margin of success is to be able to push out the status quo leaders from both parties and say, you have made yourselves irrelevant, and we need a new generation and a new group of untainted leadership who really stresses these fundamental issues and allows people to go their own way beyond that core value of restoring the Bill of Rights.
I agree with that, Peter, but I'm also one, and I think there's a hugely growing number of people who think along the same lines, finally, that strongly believe that climate protection is the most urgent and consequential issue facing not only our nation, but the entire world and the future. And those who don't want to take action, don't think the government has a role in that, I would have a really hard time urging anybody to join with them as a party. But again, if it's take all of us joining together and taking actions like Bill of Rights Defense Committee is undertaking and the coalition that it's building, I say, you know, whatever your views there are on climate or civil rights or anything else, I will lock arms with you on this issue to make certain that we don't have indefinite detention. But I'm not going to empower you to take to be able to assume any kind of governing power if you're so off base on some of these other issues like civil rights and climate protection.
I'm with you there. Yeah, I don't see these things as long-term engagements beyond, again, the what will be a long-term struggle to restore the ground lost in terms of our constitutional rights. But because we have collusion by the elected leaders of both parties at this point, I feel that the only way to restore these very important liberties is to go around them. And that, unfortunately, will require some alliances that I won't be comfortable with all the way around, but it seems to be the necessary method to achieve very important goals.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm hoping that we see some really great independent and third-party candidates coming along, both in the congressional races, midterm, and in the presidential race, and also on a local level. When I was mayor for 8 years, Peter, I had just such amazing opportunities to engage in climate protection efforts, for instance, or restorative justice efforts, or fighting against the insane war on drugs and this fraudulent DARE program that's been implemented in so many of our nation's schools. And in the process, raising awareness for people who weren't hearing about these things in the media and from most of their elected officials. So I'd encourage people to take a hard look at running for office, getting involved in the electoral process. Whatever I've said, I don't want to demean all of that. I'm just saying that's never going to be enough if we're going to see these core changes and challenges to the undermining of our constitutional republic. I mean, we have right now not only the prospect of indefinite imprisonment of people. And by the way, I like the term imprisonment much better than detention. Detention seems a bit soft. When you're actually putting people behind bars and denying them of any legal representation, maybe not even allowing their families and other loved ones to know what happened to them or where they are.
I agree. I refer to the inmates at Guantanamo as prisoners. The idea that they are detainees makes it sound like they're on just an extended sleepover, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Well, the right is really good at this kinds of framing and messaging. And, you know, even the term climate change, I try never to use that term because it is so innocuous. It's like, you know, calling Pearl Harbor a tourist visit. You know, climate change could be a good thing, I suppose, if it's just simply change. But this is absolute devastation that we're facing, and certainly our children and grandchildren will be facing. But what I wanted to say is we also have these emergency powers in place, these dictatorial powers that are ready for this president, who has already shown his leanings toward tyranny, and I don't use that term loosely. But we also have, for the first time since the Posse Comitatus Act, authorization for domestic policing by military troops under NORCOM. And we have a continuity of government plan in place that we certainly don't know what it provides for. Most members of Congress don't know, but we do know, going back to the Iran-Contra hearings, that Jack Brooks was asking Oliver North and was shut down by Senator Inouye, Daniel Inouye. He asked, were you part of a group that was putting together a continuity of government plan that entailed the suspension of the United States Constitution? And he wasn't allowed an answer to that question. That is a very frightening prospect, and it very well may be part of the current continuity of government plan that's in place today. And we, as the American people, are entitled to know, and certainly our representatives in Congress ought to know. So there's a lot that needs to be examined here, Peter, and we, the American people, we owe it not only to ourselves and our nation's heritage, but we owe it to those who come along in the future so that they can look back and say they really did stand up, and like the church committee, like the great states people that we had at one point in our nation's history, even in Congress, who said, you know, there were all these abuses during the Cold War by the intelligence community. We're going to get to the bottom of it. If it was illegal, we've got to know about it, and we've got to take steps to make certain that it never happens again. And then they did ferret out the truth through these extensive investigations. They did disclose it all to the American people and to the world, and they did take measures to try to make sure that it never happened again. We need a resurgence of that kind of true patriotism in this country, and real leadership and statesmanship and stateswomanship in the United States Congress and the White House.
Rocky Anderson, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for standing up for our constitutional rights, and look forward to talking with you again.
Thank you, Peter. Really look forward to it, and thank you, Sibel.
Rocky Anderson, visit his website, justicepartyusa.org.
Give me a star and a simple I've seen.
Leo Cohen and the future. The future. Well, that depends on us. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.